Hello, and thank you for joining us on this episode of The Dev Team. I'm Mark Onsman.
I'm Daryl Kilzer.
And I'm Jake Overall.
We're a group of developers and bootcamp instructors here to help you in joining the world as a software developer. Whether you're a self-taught developer, bootcamp grad, or a CS student, we're here to help you fill in some of the knowledge you need to grow in your role as a junior developer.
This week, Mark starts us off by exploring the almighty PWA, then I jump into the Vue 3 release One Piece and GitHub changes for the default branch name. Lastly, Daryl explains how to get us started into the world of freelance.
I'm going to start us off today talking a little bit about Word of the Week, and we're going to be talking actually about PWAs. And I know we've talked about these very briefly before in another one of my segments when we did the kind of the overrated, underrated. But I wanted to circle back to them so we could kind of give PWAs kind of their full space to talk about, you know, what they are, where they're good, and maybe some strategies and when you're using them. So first, kind of what is a PWA? Why do we have it? What are some of the benefits of it? Well, usually developers need to worry about, in this day and age, managing two applications. They have their web app and they have their native app. The idea of a PWA or a progressive web app basically eliminates the need of having to just have that main code base, which puts then everything possibly even in just the one language, potentially JavaScript, while also kind of providing some online offline first capabilities when, you know, what do I do if I'm offline? And I'll talk about those in a minute. I just wanted to kind of touch on the major advantages and disadvantages. One of the big advantages, of course, by using the same version on both mobile and desktop, your code is more stable and it's easier to maintain with versioning because you're not having to say, okay, well, I fixed this in the mobile version, but now I got to go fix it in the native, and then the web version and kind of balancing that out. As well as I don't have to worry about any maybe the idiosyncrasies of, oh, okay, well, this is some of the rules and regulations around in the Apple store, and this is some of the rules and regulations around the Android store, and possibly now I'm writing three code bases because I'm having to maintain Java and Swift and my JavaScript app, which does lead into some of the disadvantages, of course. And the reality is the native app is probably going to be faster because it is potentially able to run Java or Swift as opposed to the slower JavaScript. But what other advantages and disadvantages do you guys have you seen about, you know, using PWAs?
Yeah, the PWA is, it's an interesting world, right? And I think one of the things that is really fascinating just kind of about PWAs or what PWAs really brought to like everyone's attention kind of led us straight into things like React Native and NativeScript. And, you know, the thing that's funny is regardless of whether you are writing a PWA or you're writing NativeScript or React Native or, you know, directly writing, you know, Swift or Java, there's a layer of abstraction that's going to be talking to a lower level API. And as long as that lower or that your top level application is talking to that lower level API, which is really the device hardware that you're running on, then the concept of how we write this app should really be a business decision of, you know, what is the thing that is most profitable? What is the thing that's going to bring us the most success, right? And so that's where I've seen PWAs really shine is, again, not having to have three different code bases for a very simple application.
And kind of what you're talking about is, of course, the decoupled application architecture.
Yeah. The thing I also find funny is, you know, I've had people in the past who are like, well, how do I get my server to run on my website? Wait, what? No, wait. Everything is decoupled. It shouldn't matter. Like, and this was a question that I actually answered today for a different student was they had a question on, you know, the authentication workflow and kind of pipeline. And the question was, what does Android care about versus what does iOS care about? And the answer is nothing, right? Like neither of those platforms will actually dictate how that workflow is set up. And quite frankly, they shouldn't. You know, that is some third-party server that doesn't care what device you're actually on. You know, when you're going through something like authentication, it shouldn't matter.
Yeah, I can say, like, having built a lot of PWAs, I probably fell in the trap from one of our previous episodes, Overrated, Underrated. Definitely on board with making pretty much everything a PWA for a while. And, you know, quickly discovered, hey, this golden hammer fallacy again. You really want to look at what you're trying to build. There's certainly pros and cons to this. It's nice having the built-in caching and versioning for your website. It's nice having the singular code base. But it is a little bit limited in the sense that a true native app is definitely going to have more access to the device's capabilities and things of that nature built in.
You might say the device's API.
Sorry, what was that?
You might say the device's API.
Yeah.
Yeah, and again, not an API that is over HTTP, right? But like an API that's exposed, right? And that's where I would almost push back on you, Daryl, a little bit of the modern PWA or these libraries like React Native and NativeScript and, you know, Noxton, you know, insert flashy JavaScript framework name, right? A lot of these things have gotten really, really good at being able to directly communicate with that. It's not the true lower level API, but so much has been brought up that I can't find hardly anything anymore that I can't access through the PWA or through the browser that is on the native device, right? Like, we've got geolocation, we've got the accelerometer, we've got the camera, we've got IR sensors. I mean, we've got Bluetooth capability. There's a lot of things that we just now have directly exposed to us, right? And so that's where it's like, when I first started looking at PWA several years ago, it was, you know, things are still pretty limited, but flash forward to today and, you know, there's pretty much nothing that you can't do in either platform now.
So Daryl brought up an interesting thing a minute ago and I wanted to circle back on it, and that's essentially caching. And so I wanted to include in this a couple things, and that's basically the caching strategies that you can look at when using a PWA. Now, not the word of the day, but if you've never heard of a web worker, something to look into as we're talking about these, because oftentimes with a PWA, we'll use a web worker to maintain that caching strategy. Now, again, another throwback vocab term, caching. But that said, I wanted to kind of look at the couple different strategies. The first one is stale while revalidate. So the idea here is that I've downloaded this app onto my phone, and maybe I have the internet, and maybe I don't. So the benefit of a PWA is I can actually cache my entire website and or certain portions of my website to say, okay, when you're offline, here's some information you have access to. So that first strategy, cache while revalidate, or stale while revalidate, says basically render what is in the cache. And then after that's initially loaded and you have that first screen paint, then go fetch the actual from the network and load it and update the cache and validate and update the things on the page that need to be updated. The second one is, of course, cache first, then network. The first one you're actually going to use for like the things that are high priority and things that are important to make sure that, hey, let's make sure we get something on the page rendered. But after a moment or two, I can update that while I wait for the network to come in. The second one is cache first and then network, and this is used for mainly like images and videos, CSS, files that are not necessarily critical to the web app and that probably don't change very frequently. It's not that they never change, they're just not changed frequently. And this one would basically say, okay, I'm going to render what's in the cache if it's there, and that's it. If it's not in the cache, then I'll go ahead and fetch that data from the network, save it in the cache for next time, and grab that. So anything that's in the cache is then available for that PWA when the user is offline. And then the last two are cache only and network only. Cache only is going to be those things like your logo that almost never changes, and then network only, and that's pretty much for things that are constantly changing where you say, hey, I don't actually want you to get this if you're offline.
Yeah, have you worked with any of those? Your standard web application, how it normally works.
Yeah, when you are in your browser, pretty much everything is built to be network only. We're constantly retrieving data. So another power of the PWA is this caching process.
Yeah, and you know, there's also third-party platforms out there. Take something like Cloudflare, which will cache images and things of that nature that sit on your server anyways. You know, and Cloudflare is going to be a little bit faster, so it's going to manage that caching side of things as well that you kind of have to worry about. And, you know, this again, throwback to that other session, but caching is hard. And it's hard to get right. And ultimately, that's one of the things that a lot of people get wrong when trying to build a PWA. And it causes poor performance in the application layer. You know, it's unfortunate because PWAs are very powerful, but a lot of them are poorly built because caching is such a hard thing to maintain. And, you know, there's a lot that can kind of play in here. You know, event-based programming, which we've talked about in the past here. Your device, right, whether you're on a phone or a laptop or pretty much anything these days, will trigger an event when you have a connection to the internet and when you go out of internet connection, right? Like an event will fire that you can actually tie into and trigger different caching strategies based upon that event, right? So I think there's a lot to be said for, you know, how to cache and what to cache. And, you know, ultimately, there's a lot of business rules that are involved there. And so there's not like a one solution fits everything. And that's the hard part of building any application is figuring out like what should you do under this circumstance?
I think the kind of the last takeaway for me, and I'll let Daryl add anything if he has any, but the last takeaway for me, and I think PWAs are fun, and like he mentioned, is like the golden hammer, and you can fall into that. But I think if you've never done it before, look at some of those modern frameworks. A lot of them have built, you know, libraries or whatever, CLI tools that allow you to auto-generate some of the stuff for PWAs, and kind of play around with it, because it's a little bit exciting if you've never actually pushed a phone app to be able to produce a website that you can download on your phone and say, hey guys, look, here's the little icon on my phone of my application. So if you've never done it before, whatever language you're familiar with, whether it's Vue or Angular or React, dive into it, check it out, play around with it. They can be really fun.
Yeah, I would just throw in there, like, if you've never touched anything before, like, and you're trying to deal with this world of, you know, PWAs or building and maintaining different mobile applications, really look at NativeScript. It's got a plugin for Angular. It's got a plugin for Vue. It's got, you know, and basically it's like, let's still just build a normal application on the side, you know, and we'll use NativeScript to, you know, kind of do the React Native idea. Let's just, regardless of what JavaScript library you're using, let's boil it down and let's actually build it into like an APK or an IPA file or something of that nature.
I think that is still one of the go-to projects that I do really enjoy building. Jake touched on like cloud computing and things like that. With Cloudflare there, I like using a PWA with its caching, and then I tie it in with Google's Firestore or Firebase, and having those two different pieces of the kind of the caching cycle there makes that so much easier to implement. Plus you get push notifications and all that. So like Mark said, it's something that's really fun. It feels really impressive and very powerful that you can build a real application that can talk to your mobile devices and push to others over the cloud pretty much instantly.
That'll be it for me, though. Jake, I'll kick it over to you with the news that I was really hoping I could release, but it's on you this time.
Yeah, no. So news is exciting, except especially exciting for us here at CodeWorks, right? Vue 3 is now officially released. They had set a goal for quarter 3, right? I think it's, you know, 2 days before the end of the quarter, and they finally released. Like, good on them. You know, congrats and a shout out to, you know, Evan Yu and the Vue 3 team. Like, huge accomplishment. It's great. Comes with a lot of really new, exciting features. The composition API being one of those things. Proxy objects, which, you know, I don't know if we've necessarily discussed on this podcast before or not, but kind of a revamp of the reactivity cycle. And so a lot of pretty cool stuff that's coming with Vue 3. I do have to admit that one of the neatest things about the release is the name. And I don't know if you guys saw this or not, but they decided to go with One Piece as the name.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're an anime fan at all, like, and One Piece is a great anime, like, I love it. But the logo is pretty cool. It's, you know, the Luffy skull, and he's got a green hat and stuff. It just wonderful. Great choice, Evan. Really like it.
I can't say that I'm particularly familiar with that, but yeah, super exciting. One of the things, yeah, obviously we've been waiting for is we've kind of started to play around with some of the release candidates and seeing what's available there. Would you say that from the most part, the release candidate most recently come, and that's what we've gotten with the One Piece?
Yeah, for sure. If you've been looking or paying any attention, the RFC that was released about 4 or 5 months ago has stayed pretty consistent with what is actually now official. Like, there's been some performance improvements. There's been some, you know, double checks on tools and integrations and things of that nature. With this, the Vue router, at first, the Vue router wasn't really working with Vue 3. That's now fully updated and ready to roll as well. Vuex, which is a totally different discussion, but you know, a pattern that we're probably stepping away from here at CodeWorks. But Vuex 4 is ready, which actually runs with Vue 3, you know, because versions have to be confusing, of course. But that's ready to go. There's a new dev tools. So if you have the old Chrome or, you know, I guess Firefox, who knows how long that's going to last still. But if you have those old dev tools, it's time to uninstall the old ones and install the new ones. And that now works with both Vue 2 and Vue 3. So that's really good. And there's some new updates to those dev tools that are really nice features as well, with kind of stepping through any object that's reactive and just, you know, dynamic changes. And, you know, you still got the event cycle and everything else that gets captured, which is also really nice.
Yeah, I think that's been one of the most awesome things that they've done with the Vue 3 package. When we started looking at the RFC about a year ago, I know there was a lot of like concerns over how much it's changing, but I think they've done an amazing job with still providing that backwards compatibility, still continuing to support that, and still keeping that entry level pretty low. while kind of catering to, I think, the most exciting thing is intermediate developers and senior developers. A lot of the issues that I would run into trying to build out more enterprise level or larger applications or more complicated applications, they've kind of addressed a lot of those and given you solutions for them. So I think that's been real nice.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was a big thing for Vue 3 is, you know, they wanted to make sure that they didn't break backwards compatibility. But, you know, Vue 2 had some weird things. You know, a lot of your logic was fractured. It was broken across, you know, whether it was a watcher or a computed or a method. And, you know, you have inappropriate scoping, so you would just throw it into the data field. And, like, everything kind of felt a little, like, you know, maybe immature. Right? Maybe that's a good word for it. Very powerful, but, you know, hard to reuse logic. And that is one of the biggest issues that, you know, Vue 3 really addresses in the style of how you write it. Now, Vue 3 also has done a huge overhaul on reactivity and drawing to the DOM and, you know, swapping out the VDOM and things of that nature. You know, that's a completely different strategy now. So it's pretty neat.
Yeah, one of the big things we've talked about, especially with them kind of giving reactive objects, which are proxy objects under the hood. We did talk about those. That was the week you were out. But in those objects, basically, the benefit of using those is we can actually eliminate Vue.x in exchange for more of a service pattern. And I've always kind of pushed that service pattern as something I personally like because it's more interchangeable because if I write this service in Vue and for whatever reason down the road my company decides to switch to, you know, Angular, I can take those services as is for the most part and only modify them a little bit by who they're communicating with directly. But the functionality and the business logic remains the same for them. So we can better adhere to an MVC design pattern without kind of really breaking Vue to make that work. Here we can just implement it directly. And I know that's something you want me to talk about at Vue Toronto. Fingers crossed for you. I'm just trying to stall for 8 more days, so I accidentally missed the deadline.
Yeah, you need to get that done. I think that's something that is very important, and that is, you know, the concept of single responsibility, right? Like, these front-end frameworks are supposed to be supportive in nature. They should be, and a lot of them, you know, they claim, hey, we're a Vue engine, right? Like, let us handle the Vue, let us handle the reactive, let us handle the drawing and the updating and all that stuff, but keep your business logic your business logic. And that should be something that is transferred between any application. And again, if you want to talk about layered architecture, things of that nature, like you have a UI layer and you have a business layer. The business layer should be separate, even in the client where, you know, everything's kind of smushed together anyways. But I mean, that's a whole nother topic for a whole nother day. I think we could deep dive on that for hours and hours. But the other bit of news that I wanted to bring up is GitHub starting October 1st. I'm not sure if you guys have seen this or not, but they have made the decision to drop the master branch in favor of a main branch, right? So all new repositories going forward starting October 1st, when you create them on GitHub, will be created with the main branch, which I think is actually a really good move for GitHub. Now, again, this doesn't necessarily change Git itself, which is local to your computer, but it is a good thing. And GitHub truthfully has just over the last month made it a lot easier to, you know, create new branches, change your default branch, rename branches, you know, specify a specific like deploy branch. And so there's a lot of changes that GitHub itself has been doing just around the concept of, you know, making branching what it really truthfully should be in a Git type architecture or a Git type system. Branches are something that you shouldn't be afraid of. You know, they should be very easily accessible and, you know, have some rules and some basic concepts built around them. And a name is just a name, so, you know, we can change it very easily. And it's really not going to break massive workflows or anything. Now, GitHub has also come out and said, you know, this is not a forced migration for old repositories because, you know, there are a lot of things that could potentially go wrong in switching over, you know, your primary branch name, but you know, that is something that they are pushing for, they are encouraging, and there's a lot of tutorials and help now around, you know, making that shift.
Yeah, it's definitely kind of that progressive move that they're due for. And I think I have to kind of give credit where credit is due a little bit. You know, obviously Microsoft purchasing GitHub some time ago, and we're starting to see those changes and those improvements come in. And so, you know, whether that was their influences or plans that GitHub had anyway, certainly good changes, not necessarily dev news, but Microsoft did buy Bethesda. So maybe they can implement good changes there. Maybe a better release strategy for them as well. But back to GitHub, I think that's, yeah, certainly something that, you know, is their direction and is good for them and is good for the community. And quite frankly, most of the time, I'm changing those branch names anyway, right? We talked about this a little bit last week with the new Git CLI, but it's that when I set up, it's like, okay, well, I have my production branch and I have my dev branch and I have, you know, so on and so forth. I've eliminated main or master or whatever it is when I first set up anyway.
Yeah. And I think that that's, you know, again, just making that whole UI easier from like the GitHub interface, like that's great. And I'm really glad that they've decided to make that decision. I'd also just kind of point out, like, you know, with the purchase of Microsoft, you know, GitHub has really become an enterprise level tool. And so it's nice that we actually now have an enterprise level backer.
Yeah, it's definitely starting to feel, I'm saying professional here. That's not exactly the word, but it's feeling a lot more like a real true developer tool. I think before it was very much like this thing that was kind of a side project that grew really big and got really popular. And now Microsoft's really putting the backing to it and making it that enterprise level since it's being used that way. And that GitHub CLI should hopefully make changing over your old branches or fixing up some of those workflows pretty quick. You should be able to write a script for it and just run it and fix all that up.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that's one of the great things about scripting. I also think, you know, we talk about, you know, different services. You have like, you know, platform as a service, which, you know, GitHub is now kind of more of a full-featured platform, right? And so, you know, there's a lot that it can do. Yes, it's now got task runners. Yes, it's got everything else built into it. And so, you know, it's fascinating to actually see how far GitHub has even come, I would say, in the last, like, year and a half.
I mean, you can run VS Code within GitHub.
Yeah, Code Spaces, which is... anyways, super, I think we're cool. Drifting a little bit too much in the news type of idea, but just really great stuff that we see coming out of GitHub right now. And again, it's been rapid fire changes this year.
Can't not touch on this just before we wrap that one up. Pretty sure Microsoft bought up Bethesda just so that they could push 20 more renditions of Skyrim out for us.
I think Skyrim on my microwave, if I could get that.
I mean, who doesn't want to play Skyrim in the console?
Yeah, that's good for at least 20 remasters, right? All right. So I wanted to talk this week about getting started in freelancing. And this is something that, you know, I've got a fairly extensive background in. I've always been fairly entrepreneurial. And this is a topic that comes up incredibly often from students through our cohorts. Either they're wanting to get into it right off the bat just for something as a side gig or going at it full time. Either way, I think the outcome or the decisions you have to make are kind of the same. One of the big things that I think you need to nail down first is kind of those expectations between you and your client. What I found through personal experience is it's very easy to kind of get wrapped up in a project and go, okay, that sounds really easy from what I'm thinking of, say yes to it, and then the client has this completely different vision of this large-scale application that's just going to take way too much time and you're going to be way underpaid for. It's hard to ask for that up front, but that's something that you kind of got to do, or you're going to fall into that trap and overwork yourself, or under-deliver or over-deliver. Either way, it's just kind of bad news for both you and the client.
I think that's probably, what most people are trepidatious about when they think of freelancing is like, how do I set my worth and how do I figure out how much should I charge? And I think that you're exactly right. That exploration phase of what do you actually need becomes incredibly important because they could be, you know, give you kind of the full description of what they think they need. And at the last minute be like, oh, and I need this one just extra little tiny feature. And it turns out what for them is a tiny feature is like complete integration of some entirely other platform. So I think that's, you know, that exploration is let's really take the time to define the project. So then I can determine better estimation of how many hours I have and how much I charge an hour.
So you start off with a funny word there, right? And the word is client, right? Like you said, I need to set the expectations between myself and my client. Right. And so I think the first thing that a lot of people who are, you know, starting to venture into this, you know, thought of like, hey, I want to be a freelance developer or whatever. But the first question is, how do I even get a client? Right.
Absolutely.
But to echo what you just said and what Mark was just saying is, you know, regardless of who your client is, you need to define what is your scope of work? What is your scope of services? Right. And the clients will come once you've defined what it is you do. right? And I think that is actually a very important piece first and foremost is you need to decide what it is that you're offering before you ever even think about getting a client. Because otherwise, yeah, you're going to end up with a client who wants X when you don't know how to deliver it and you can only do Y. And that's not to say that you shouldn't push yourself to learn new things, but in the world of freelance, especially very first getting started, you need to make sure that your scope is narrow and that you stay on target. Otherwise, you're going to be, you know, defunded and, you know, not have the means necessary to actually support yourself.
Absolutely. And that is my exact answer. And my exact advice to that is pick a niche. So I was, you know, of course, naturally good with game development. And so that is, of course, what I picked to do. And to get the clients, I went with Upwork. I decided, hey, I don't really have a full schedule to devote to trying to find clients. I'm going to pick a platform and it's going to do that for me. I'm going to limit the jobs that I look at. They're just going to be game development and strictly mostly kind of scripting small scale, not full projects. And so that was one of the, like, some of the parameters that I set around it. This was strictly a side gig. I only wanted a couple hours here and there, and it made it very easy to kind of control those first parameters. And so that's kind of what you got to define is how much time are you going to put into this, set those expectations for yourself, find those clients through that, and then set the expectations there.
Yeah, and you know, this is an interesting thing, and I know that this will play to your strengths, Daryl. You know, some of the very best video games ever made are the ones that had the tightest constraints, right? Like, we look at like very early gaming systems, the constraints of the system dictated what types of games were even possible. And in today's world, computers are so powerful, systems are so powerful, these new consoles are so powerful. There's almost nothing that you can't do. And not having any type of constraint, like, how wild do you go in game development in particular, too? Like, if there's absolutely no constraints, what type of stuff have you built with no constraints, Daryl?
Yeah, it's kind of that scope bleed factor, right? Like, you can make this thing that can do all kinds of stuff. Ultimately, it's going to be a lot of hours, a lot of time consumed. May not even have any, you know, return of investment there. And so that's kind of my big advice there is figure out exactly what you're going to do. Start off with, kind of like you said, something you're very comfortable with. So I went with game development, then I progressed to web development since I was a new skill at the time, and then eventually teaching. You know, finding, hey, I'm good at Vue. This is something I enjoy. I'm good at teaching. Here's small little projects that I can take on. There's, you know, right now might be a great time with Vue 3 releasing. Go teach someone the composition API. When the Vuex store was new and there were people switching over to Vue, that was one of the things that I picked up was a lot of people just wanted me to walk them through. They were real developers. They just wanted me to spend 4 hours walking them through how that works and implementing it in their project. It's a great way to kind of get out there, get some hours in, and kind of see how long it takes you to do something. Because that exploration process, like Mark was saying, is going to be key there.
I think, and I would be, of course, remiss to not mention this as the role of the team I play and the certifications I have, agile. You need to continue that agile development process, especially in freelance work. Waterfall is a terrible experience for both the developer and the client. You touched on that right there, where it's early on and that I want to build this because I think this is what you want, but then it turns out the client didn't want that. So that constant communication of an agile development cycle and setting those expectations with them earlier, okay, here's how I'd like to approach this. Let's break this into kind of cycles or sprints or whatever you need to do to get them on board with here's the agile process, and we're doing it this way to make sure you and I are on the same page all throughout the building of this application.
Yeah, I think one of the key things there is, you know, the idea of a constant deliverable, right? Like, put the app in the hands of the client as often as possible so that we get, you know, feedback and constructive, you know, pathing as early as possible, right? And I think that's, you know, one of the key reasons why the agile development process is, you know, in the end, turns out to be a much better experience for everyone involved, right? But that does open up the discussion, and something that I have faced a lot in doing, you know, my own freelance stuff is, you know, it's not uncommon for people who have, you know, this is the very first app that they're trying to build. You know, they have money. They say, look, I've got $5,000 and I need it to do this. How do we get in $5,000 to do this? Right. And it's like they want us to pick a very specific budget and they want us to pick a very specific time. And they want you to be able to say, yes, that's what it's going to be. Right. And the agile concept makes that a very, very hard discussion. And that's one of the, you know, one of the problems that I was running into a lot, especially in early freelance, was, you know, hey, well, but that's not really how we do it in the developer industry. And trying to convey that to, you know, people who have never even heard the word agile before. What? Like, you know, so that's something you will run into. So what are your guys' you know, tips and tricks for getting that?
Yeah, I would almost never accept an undefined project like that. Hey, here's $5,000 and I want this thing. That was one of the things that I learned the hard way, for sure, early on. Given a small game project, well, what I thought was small, the way it was described sounded very small, and it almost immediately ran way over budget really quickly and didn't want to pay for it, and then left with a broken code base, and it just bad news all around. I would never, ever accept something like that. I would come back and propose, hey, let's try a much shorter contract. This will either way get you towards your goal, and someone else can pick this up if you're not happy with where we get to. Or it's a proof of concept here, and I think this is something you need. It sounds like you don't have very many parameters around your actual project. Let's do this quick proof of concept here and save you some money instead of you trying to invest all of this. One that instills trust in there, they'll probably continue to work with you, and you'll usually find that they have a much larger budget than they originally said. It's something I've ran into almost every single time. They always try to underdeliver, so be careful of that too. That is something that I think a lot of our students fall into, actually. Usually when I go to help them, they are taking on this massive project. They come to me with this massive problem, and I'm like, okay, so what are you, you know, how many hours are you working on this? What's your budget? And it's usually just way under. I'm like, ooh, you shouldn't have said yes to that. Like, know your worth, for sure.
Missed estimations, right?
Yeah.
I think that the other important thing to avoid there, and you're kind of alluding to it there, is to never take an application on as a pay this one price, get this one app, because it's never going to work that way. You need to break it down and say, okay, well, in the client coming to you at that point, you have to kind of say, all right, well, you know, I know what your end goal is now, and I know what your end budget is. So let's rein that down and let's talk about maybe what we could do for a week, 2 weeks of work. And again, sticking with that agile process, your first sprint should not be pretty much more than 1 to 2 weeks, because ultimately that's when you can touch base again and say, okay, now that you've seen what I can achieve in a week or two, here's the cost of that. From there, you can set that expectation and they can then know, all right, do I wish to continue investment or not? And they're lower in the investment chain. They haven't just handed you a bunch of money and asking for refunds and, you know, the whole mess. The second part of that I think is really important to help clients understand is software development's a triangle. And you have fast and cheap and robust, right? It's good, it's fast, it's cheap, pick two. And we'll build your app from there.
Yeah, I think that's definitely, there's a lot of truth to that. Something else that we haven't even touched on is as a freelance developer, right? If you're taking on a project, there's a whole pipeline, there's a whole like delivery process that you really should have in place, kind of ironed out before you ever even take on a project, right? Like, how are you going to put the app into the hands of the client? And how are you going to do it on a regular basis? And how are you going to let them see the work that you are making? I've found that transparency is kind of the best thing. And there's a little bit of, you know, this, when I've taken on clients in the past, it's, you know, I usually say, well, I need at least one person from your organization or your team or whoever this client is. And I say, I'm going to train you just a little bit on how to use like a Kanban board, how to log into this thing, how to, you know, look at source code, how to, you know, just a very top level overview. And then, you know, here's a domain that you're going to go to, or here's, I'm going to email you a weekly, like, installable application that you can put on your device or something of that nature, right? But there's a necessary pipeline that puts the app back into the hands of the client on a, you know, weekly or biweekly basis, or, you know, a sprint, right? Whatever your sprint cycle is. But you better have a constant deliverable if you expect to be able to keep a client, especially on that agile methodology, right? Like, and I think it turns out really nice. It's, you know, I know exactly what I'm getting for the work that is being performed. And while I don't understand the work that's being performed, I get to see the end goal.
I would also try and push, if you're jumping in on a project that already exists, really push to see if you can see what the code base is like before you dive into it. Because you might be diving into a project and they're going to pay you XYZ, but when you actually get in there and you see the code base that exists, you were supposed to extend a feature, but this code base is a nightmare and it's absolute garbage and there's no way you're going to be able to interface with it without really almost rewriting the whole application. And so now you've said, I'm going to deliver XYZ feature, but holy cow, that I can't because of what's here. I have to rewrite everything, and now we're in much more time.
Yeah, cardinal sin of any developer is saying, I'll take on a project that already has an existing code base and saying yes to it before you've seen the existing code base. Like, never, never again.
There is some ever would absolute I do that. Garbage code out there. And yeah, you say never would you do it again, right?
Many of us it was a mistake that I had to learn from, very much like Daryl was talking about.
Yeah, I've done that before. And what I do now is I'll actually tell them, okay, here's the normal price I would do it at. So let me times that by 5. Here you go. Or I can rewrite this in my preferred framework. If they agree to it, then okay, I can use money as my motivator. But that's the thing. You really got to make that number. Sometimes it's a ridiculous number. Most of the time they'll say no. I've had them say yes. So you got to be aware that might end up being the case.
Well, and there are some, you know, constraints that companies are like, well, you know, we've invested X amount in this app. It is good. Like, we have so much time, energy, effort here that we can't just let you rewrite the entire code base. Or there's other constraints. It's like, no, we can't use that framework. No, we can't use that library. So sometimes, yes, you do have to work within those constraints, of course. I think one of the things, and this goes back to being able to identify your scope, is are you capable of actually taking on that task? And the worst thing you can do as a freelance developer, especially first getting started, trying to build your name, trying to build your credibility, is taking on projects that are beyond your scope. You know, you don't want to do that because you will get bad reviews, especially if you're on a site like Upwork or, you know, one of those things. Like, all it takes is one bad review and you're not going to get the next client.
Nothing will tank you faster than that. Absolutely. Getting started, you got to think the whole application through. How am I going to deploy it? All of that, just like you said. And be okay with passing up the first job that comes along. There will be plenty more. That's the thing that I found is there's plenty more. I wait for the ones that fit my time frame and my skill set.
Yeah, I would add that as my very last note is 100% that. Look at what you're skilled in. And it's different than when you apply for a job. When you apply for a job, you're applying for a job because you meet 30 to 50% of the requirements in the job and you're hoping that that's enough that they'll hire you. When you're applying for freelance, you should probably be fairly comfortable with 90% or more.
Yeah, I don't think I ever take anything that I'm less than like 90%, and I'm very, very comfortable in most of that 90%.
All right, well, we will go ahead and wrap up the podcast there today. And again, if you've enjoyed these podcasts, please be sure to like and subscribe on whatever your favorite podcast network is. And until then, thanks for joining us this week and have a great rest of your week. Thank you for joining us for this episode of The Dev Team. If you're interested in learning more about our team or possibly starting a career in software development, reach out to us at boisecodeworks.com. Follow us on Facebook and like and subscribe to this podcast to continue to receive the latest updates. Until then, from The Dev Team, remember, if you want clean code, wash your hands.